Well, we have a really good number ready here tonight for a Sunday night. And lately, our Sunday evening crowds have been bigger, so that's good. I don't know how I managed to do this, but I get it all tangled up, so give me a moment here. I announced this morning that the lesson was going to be, I tried to make it sound like it was going to be better than normal. I don't know if I'm going to deliver it better than normal, but the passage is a very special one from the book of Ecclesiastes that I'm going to take a look at. And in particular, it will go a lot of it will go with the lesson from this morning and the idea of being at peace. And let me just start off by saying or acknowledging that there are things that we face in life, as we were talking about this morning, things that would disrupt the peace in our life, would take away or steal even from being at peace within ourselves, in our life, etc. This particular week, and I noted this morning, indeed, we're thinking about various things. I have friends that lost a young son at the age of 25. I have a sister-in-law who suddenly lost her sister on Monday afternoon. Really have not explained. No one really understands why as of yet. She had gone to the doctor, ironically, for a physical a few days before. There was nothing wrong. She just had a heart attack and died, and she was 44. Drowning accident, young man, last Sunday, right after services Sunday morning. Scott and Bertina Smelser's son. And there are other things. There are circumstances here that are going on within this place. We know of people who have illnesses. We know of folks who have family members. We could go on and on with that. The point is, there are things in life that, as we said this morning, as we stress, and I don't want to belabor the point, but things that we have to face. We have to deal with them because they are a normal part of life. And some of these things, and tonight, these are the kinds of things I'm going to really be looking at, I'm going to be focusing on. They're the kinds of things that don't just come and go in our life. You know, there are plenty of things that in life, that circumstances that rise up, and they may even at the time seem to be a great, big, huge thing, but they pass. And once they pass, they're really gone. And unless you are reminded, you know, maybe somebody reminds you of it, or you run across something that reminds you, you just don't think about it. And yet there are other things that are, and the way I like to put it, they're just always there. Right below the surface, it doesn't take much to trigger the memory. It doesn't take much even to evoke the emotions about it. They're always going to be there. And the older you get, those things are going to accumulate in your life. You realize, you know, the older you get, most of us do, we're not very old when death touches us, when we lose someone, maybe like this week in certain people's case. But when you lose loved ones and you realize, you know what, that is going to be a natural part of life. And there are other circumstances. Trouble comes, sometimes very bad trouble, the kind of trouble that tears apart relationships or tears apart friendships or whatever it might be. They're going to be, in many cases, because of people and the way they live. They're going to be divorces. They're going to be all of those kinds of things. And we're going to suffer that. And it's going to be the kind of thing that we deal with for all our lives. For example, if you were a child like I was, and divorce came to you and your family as a child, it forever changes the circumstance of your family. It's never going to change. And you are going to have to deal with that. Now, how you deal with it is a decision. And sometimes you need to revisit that decision, maybe many times in your life. You can, and I've come to say it this way, this is not original with me. In fact, the first person I heard talk about it like this was Zig Ziglar. I don't know if it was original with him or not. But you have to either respond or react to the situation. And as he said, and I'll borrow from him to say that, to respond is positive, to react is negative. He went on to talk about that, but I think you can just think about the words and think about the language. You can respond to something in a positive manner. You can react against something in a negative manner. The point is you've got to deal with it. And how you deal with that and how you deal with certain things becomes your attitude of approach, your disposition, as it were. And when you talk about disposition, think about the passage that Ed just read. God has called us to certain things, not to fear, not to approach life in fear, like, oh man, I can't handle this. And, you know, if life just keeps going like it is, I'm never going to be able to handle it and I'm going to fall apart. God has not called us to that. On the other hand, God has called us to love, and He's called us to peace, as we talked about this morning. And as that passage that I chose for Ed to read tonight, as that passage emphasizes, He has chosen us to be self-controlled individuals. Now, we forget that sometimes. I know I certainly do. And maybe we even forget it for a period of time. And there have been periods of time when I've forgotten that. But I know that that's the way God calls us to live our lives. He calls us to have this disposition that we will face what we have to face, the circumstances that inevitably come. We will face those things as Christians should. I want to read a couple of New Testament passages, and then I'm going to spend the bulk of the lesson in that Old Testament passage I want to emphasize from Ecclesiastes. But go with me to James chapter 1 to start with. In James 1, and beginning in verse 2, James says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into divers or various temptations, trials, tests." Count that as joy. A lot of times we might look at that and we say, how would I do that? Why is it a joyful thing to be tested by God or to be tempted, etc., etc.? Count it as joy. Why? Because you know something, verse 3. Christians know this, that the trying or the testing of your faith works. It produces patience. Endurance is the word. And then he goes on to say, let patience or let endurance have its complete work. Let it have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, lacking nothing. Now, you've heard me quote that or read that many times. I quote it many, many, many times to myself. If you let the circumstances of life run their course and you deal with them as God calls you to deal with them, you're going to be better off. And that's what God is teaching us here. If you lack the wisdom to face it or to deal with it, notice verse 5, ask of God. Now go with me to Romans 5, and I call this a companion passage to James 1. But Paul says something very similar in Romans 5. And so I'm going to start in verse 1 of Romans 5, where he says, we are justified by faith. Now certainly not by faith only, but we are made right by faith. Tonight I'm going to emphasize that. I think that means many things. But one of the things it certainly means is this. When my life is turned upside down by circumstances, when I'm facing something and it has made me, you know, change my thinking, it's made me view life in a different way, and sometimes that's not always good, you know. But I'm made right by my faith. I'm made right by the faith of God. I can always come back to that. I can always return to that. That's my foundation of life, my faith. And the stronger I am in faith, the more faith I have. And I don't just mean, you know, foundationless belief. I'm talking about the faith as God speaks of, the faith that comes from Him and the hearing of His Word. I'm made right by that faith. Now listen to the way Paul says it. Therefore, being justified or made right by faith, we have peace, as we talked about this morning, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom, that is, by Jesus also, we have access by faith into this grace or favor wherein we stand, and we rejoice in hope of the glory of God. Now, verse 3, very much like what James was saying, and not only so, but we glory in tribulations, in troubles. Again, that seems upside down. That seems wrong. It shouldn't be that way. And yet a Christian can glory in tribulations. Why? Because we know that tribulation or trouble works patience. It works or produces endurance. And endurance or patience works experience. Literally the word here for experience is what we might call experiments. And if we want to look at it like that, and I think the cynic looks at it, or taking a cynical view, you would say that, well, what God has done is create a bunch of lab rats and put us through a bunch of experiments. Well, it's not that. Because God is allowing us to go through these tests, our experiments, our proofs, really. Sometimes it's translated that way. So that we may come out of it
better, stronger than we were before. So notice as Paul says, endurance works experience, and experience produces hope. And hope makes not ashamed. And the point of this passage is this. I stand in my faith. I've come through at the age of 54 now. I've come through a lot of experiments in life. I've gone through a number of tests and proofs. There's still more to go if God chooses for me to live a longer life, and all things being equal, I will do that. There's still more to go through. And if I'm going to go through those things, if I go through them with my faith intact, or when I feel myself losing a grip on my faith or losing my faith, I come back to it. And I approach everything with God. I take everything as it comes in a self-controlled manner with faith, or, as going back to what I was saying in the beginning, my disposition is, with God and in faith, I will respond to whatever comes. And I know that I will learn certain things. I'll take a positive attitude about whatever comes in life and whatever is in the future. I don't know what is in the future, but I know it will be something. And my attitude about it will be, I will continue to learn things. I will learn things about myself. Who am I really? You know, when I was a young person, a child, I thought I was a certain person. I'm amazed at how different I am. There's still plenty of things that are like that child 50 years ago. I am still me. You are still you. But I've grown. And I've changed. And I've found out who I am. I've learned through these experiments, if you will, what I am and who I am and what I will do. I've learned weaknesses that I never dreamed I had. And I've learned strengths that I would have never believed I had. I learn about myself. I learned what I really can do. I've told you many times that Mike Douglas uses the phrase, and so I'll borrow this from him. These are the things in life that test your mettle. In other words, it tests to see what you are made of. Are you going to respond generally in life and rise, as it were, to the top and be what God wants you to be? Or are you simply going to react and always be negative about everything in life and always be knocked down and always be far less than you can be? You learn what you really can do. It tests your mettle. And you learn what you really want to do. There's an ancient quote. I used to attribute it to Julius Caesar. For the life of me, I can't find the... I looked for it this week. I couldn't find it. But somebody said, you know, we ultimately do exactly what we want to do. I want you to think about that phrase. We ultimately do exactly what we want to do. I believe that. I believe that in the end, I end up doing exactly what I want to do about everything. I make the choices. I give in. I rise above. I conquer. I am defeated. Whatever happens is because I do that. My choice, my decision. And finally, I think you learn some things that are very important like this. Who's really with you? You know, when I was young and running around with a gang of people, you know, when you're young and stupid, you think a gang of people is the strongest group, the closest bond you can possibly have. None of those people are with me now. None of them. There was a time when I thought, you know, I could count on this gang to be behind me in everything. That this gang would be with me through the rest of my life. None of those people are here. But there are people that have stuck with me. There are people who are behind me. There are people who really care about me. Now, they haven't always been the ones who patted me on the back or supported me in everything I chose to do. But they're there, and they care. And you learn that. Who's really with you? Who can you count on? And I think more than anything else, when you say that, you learn Jesus is there. You can really count on Jesus, and He will always be there. Now, go with me to Ecclesiastes. Having said all of that, and I wanted to set this passage up, I'm going to start in Ecclesiastes chapter 6, and I'm in one sense jumping right in the middle of a discussion of the writer here, and yet at the same time, well, if I can remember where Ecclesiastes is, so we'll look again for it. Ecclesiastes 6, I'm jumping right in the middle of this. But it is when the writer introduces one of those things you have to deal with, maybe one of the worst things you have to go through in life. But he starts off by asking a question, making an observation, really, in verse 11. And this is Ecclesiastes 6, verse 11. And he says, seeing there are many things that increase vanity. Vanity is a key word in the book. You know, vanity is that which is without profit and futility. And maybe some of your translations say that. And there are many things that would increase profitlessness or futility in your life. So he asks the question, since there are a whole lot of those things, what is man the better? Or another way of saying that, and I think a translation or two does, how can man ever be better off if that's the case? In other words, if your life is filled with and you're surrounded by things that are futile, things that are going to tear you down or tear you apart, how can you ever be better off for that? Are we really better off for all these things that come in life? Am I better off for that? Doesn't seem like it, certainly at the time. But I want to suggest that a Christian can't help but be better off. Now, we've just read two passages and stressed them, James and Romans. And we've talked about how both writers say, these things come, you should count it all joy, or Paul, you should glory in them because of what you know. And basically what they're saying is what you know is you will be better. There's another passage in Romans, and I'm sure you know it and can quote it, but in Romans chapter 8 and verse 28, all things work together for good to those who love the Lord. Now, is that really true? I mean, people copy it on index cards or print it out on their computer or whatever. We find it on pictures, photos, etc. Is it really true? Do you really believe that everything in life, all things, everything is good and works together for good to those who love the Lord, our love God? Now, certainly those who love the Lord would be Christians. So is everything in your life, and you should stop for a moment and reflect on everything in your life. Good things, bad things, things of great consequence, things of no consequence. Is everything in your life working together for good because you love God? Someone has said, you know, lines like that or things like that in the Bible are beyond belief. Well, I don't think so. And I'll tell you the reason I don't think so is because I really believe in a God that is that big. If I didn't, I would sit back and I would say, God cannot possibly take everything, every little tiny thing, every circumstance in every human being's life, not even in all the Christians' lives of the world. I don't know how many Christians there are in this world right now. It'd probably number in the millions. And even all the Christians' lives. And make it turn out for good. But he can't. He is that powerful, that great, and his wisdom, this wisdom, is that all-encompassing. And so, the writer of Ecclesiastes asked the question, since there are all these things out here that work toward making your life be filled with just futility, how can you ever be better off? And God answers that and says, you can be better off because I can make it great. I can turn it into what's good. And I believe the Christian understands if he can ever learn to accept, and this is what it comes down to, doesn't it? If I can ever learn to accept that, number one, God knows I don't. How many times have you ever said that to yourself? I hope you have many times. When you face something you can't possibly understand, you don't know why you ever got into this or God ever let you get into this, or why this ever happened in your life, and there's just no way to answer all the questions about it, how many times have you ever said, God knows and I don't? And with that faith, and I don't consider it blind faith, again, that's a God who is that powerful. If I can ever accept that God knows and I don't, and beyond that, God knows what is good for me and I don't, Someone's likened it to this. In fact, it's been likened to this many times. If you take a young child, a small child, especially one that has had candy, okay, and all young children, practically, that have had candy, love candy. And if you took them into, whatever, a shop, and in that shop there was the choice of green peas and Brussels sprouts, spinach, and, you know, maybe a steak or whatever it might be, and that 3 to 5 year old child had the choice between that and candy, what would the child choose? Child's going to run to candy. And if you let that child go back in an hour, it's going to run to candy. And if you let the child continue to run back, it's going to go to candy, to candy, to candy, and candy, until it literally dies from malnutrition. And what God is saying is, if you got to design your life, if you got to choose, you would be just like the little kid. You would always choose the candy. You would never choose to go through the difficult, most difficult things you've had to go through. You would never choose to do that. You would never choose to lose a loved one or suffer through someone really hurting to the point that it rips you apart. You would never choose that. And you would never choose to be tempted with the sins that are going to rise up and overwhelm you so that you, for example, in your own personal life, lose your Garden of Eden. You would never choose that. But God would choose it because you have to have it if you're going to be what you must be when you die. And the point of all of that is, I have to approach that and I have to have a disposition that says, use any phrase you want to use for it. I'm bearing my cross. I'm paying my dues. I'm going through my experiences that's producing all that needs to be produced within me. I'm growing by all, whatever it takes. But you learn to say what you have to say and think what you have to think. Feel what you have to feel. So that you understand God knows and I don't. God knows what is good for me and I don't. God will choose the green peas and the Brussels sprouts instead of the candy. I wouldn't, but God will, because God loves me. I'm going to be better off for it. And you'll notice in this passage, and read it again with me, Ecclesiastes 6, verses 11 and 12. And this is very interesting, or at least I think it is. Seeing there are many things that increase vanity or futility, what is man the better? How can man be better off? For, verse 12, for who knows what is good for man in his life, or in this life, all the days of his vain life, which he spends as a shadow. For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? God can. And only God. If I look at the situations in my life, especially when they first present themselves, and I say, who knows what is good for me? God does. And if I say, who knows what will come after this? God does. Because God knows me, and God knows what I need. Now let's go on into chapter 7, and let's read a few verses here. I'm not going to go through all of chapter 7, but just the first part of it. Because it is very interesting what the writer does, or what God does with this. In Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 1, he says, a good name is better than precious ointment, or costly perfume is the idea. And the day of death is better than the day of one's birth. When you stop and reflect on that, and we could spend the rest of the lesson and a long time meditating on that, but let's boil it down and make it really simple. A good name is rather to be chosen. A good name is better than precious or costly ointment. I believe what he is saying is this. In the biblical sense, a good name has to do with your reputation or what you are. You know, in a very real sense, your name is right now either recorded in the book of life or it is not. And at the end of time, good names are going to be the names that can be read off of the book of life. Those that are right with God. A good name is better than anything costly. In this case, he's talking about costly ointment or whatever, precious ointment. But if I end this life with a good name, and it doesn't matter what kind of name I've had at different points in my life, or you've had in different points in your life, and it doesn't matter necessarily what somebody thinks about you. You know, people, your name is probably the best name in the world, you know, best sounding name. If somebody called your name to certain people, they go, oh, that person is great. And there may very well be, and I know is the case with me, if you called my name to some of those people, they say, oh, that's the dirtiest dog that ever walked the face of the earth. Does that matter? No. Because here we're talking about what your name is and how it stands with God. A good name in the biblical sense, like Proverbs 22, and I'm not going to turn and read it, but you know the passage there as well. A good name is better than anything in this life. Notice as he goes on here, the day of death is better than the day of one's birth. That doesn't seem right, does it? When children are born, for the most part, all things being equal, when children are born, people rejoice. You know, so we've had, I think we've counted up about 8 babies either have been born or are in the process of being born or going to be born shortly in this congregation. We're not going to come to this place without a baby crying, especially on a Sunday morning. You know, anytime soon. And we rejoice about babies. And you see people all over the congregation. You know, somebody, the young mothers come in, the babies are being carried around, everybody wants to look at it, ooh and ah, and all. It's just a time of rejoicing. But when someone dies, we cry. We can't help it. And I understand all the reasons why for both. But you understand that the writer here is looking at it from a certain viewpoint. The day of one's death is better than the day of birth. Why? Well, you know, if you think of death as the end of everything and you think of birth as the beginning of everything, then you would rejoice at birth and only cry at death. But it's not, is it? When a child is born, we all would have to step back and say, we would look at the child and we would see all the innocence the child has, for example, knowing that if that child matures, that child grows up, there's a lot of heartache waiting for that child. That's not too happy. And if we look at that child and we think of all the trouble that can happen in life, of all the things that child can suffer, we could get sad very quickly. And on the other hand, if we understand death for the Christian, for the godly person with the good name, if we understand that just like Paul said, to live is Christ, what does that mean, to live is Christ? For Paul, it meant being beaten, stoned, being lied about and lied on and lied to. It meant a host of things like that. But to die is great gain. And so if I look at it like that and I begin to think about the day of my birth as opposed to the day of death, if I die faithful to God, it is the greatest day of my life. It is the time when I leave all of that behind and I enjoy great reward. I think when you understand it like that, you can't help but rejoice and be glad that someone has passed from this life. You know, you think about the Apostle Paul. I know Paul wanted to live, being human, being normal. But the day they cut Paul's head off was the best day of his life. He got to go to absolute bliss. And there would never be a time when he would suffer again. And you notice what the writer is saying here then. You can be afraid of death. And certainly if you're going to face the wrath of God, you should be. But God, just like Ed read, has not called us to fear. Christian doesn't have to be afraid. If you're right with God, there is no need to fear. You don't have to get in a car and worry that you might die. Get on a plane and be frightened that it might crash. You don't have to sit around and be anxious or filled with anxiety that you are getting older. And that means probably that in the next few short years, there's going to be a heart attack or cancer or whatever it might be, and you're going to die. Christians don't have to be filled with that anxiety because they have God. And you even learn, I think, as you mature. And I believe it takes maturity. Don't misunderstand. But as you mature in God, you begin to eagerly anticipate it. If we look at what Paul is saying in Philippians 1, go back to that passage. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain. So I'm in a strait betwixt two, as the King James says. In other words, I'm kind of pulled from both sides. I really have a desire to depart. You know what Paul is saying there? I really want to die. I'm not being morbid. I'm not being suicidal. I choose to live because I know that's better for people here. But I really, really want to die. I really want to go on and enjoy what waits for me for that long eternity of my life. And so the writer is talking about that. Read verses 2 through 4 here. It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. In other words, it's better to go to a funeral than a party. And what he's saying is, for that's the end of all men. The living will lay it to his heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of his countenance, of his heart is made better. For by the sadness, the countenance of his heart is made better. Here's the point the writer is saying. And I'll illustrate it with a story. This is a real story that happened to me. A number of years ago, and it would be, 25, near almost 30 years ago now, I went to a funeral home, and I had a family member that had died, elderly family member. So I'm at the funeral home, and there was a guy I knew, and I had known him for quite a while. He wasn't a Christian or anything like that. We weren't best of friends, but we knew each other pretty well. And he was there, too. And so I'm like, oh, wow, hey, you know, what are you doing here? His mother had died. And the guy was all messed up from his mother dying. And as we stood there and talked, you know, a little bit, and I could tell that he was really messed up, really torn up about it, and I was trying to console him, whatever. He said, you know what, man? And he just kind of starts doing this right here. You know what, man? I just need to get out of here and get drunk. And I thought, how sad. The sad commentary on life. I don't want to think about this. I don't want to be serious about this. I don't want to contemplate that this is life. You get old and you die. I don't want to think about this. I just want to get out of here and party. I want to get drunk and not think about it. The writer is saying it is better to go to the house of mourning. Because when you are sober in your thinking, pardon the pun. But when you're serious about life and you think about things the way you should, you'll lay it to heart. Now, laying it to heart doesn't mean you'll just think about it in a passing way. You will really think about it. I don't know about you, but when I go to funerals, and without exception, there is never one that I go to that I don't sit there, and I'm sure this is the case for you, that you don't sit there and think about, if time goes on, this is me one day. I will be here, and there will be people sitting around thinking about my life. But far more than that, I will meet God in judgment. And it's a very sobering thing. And notice as he goes on here, if you will, in verse 5. And let's read this together, verses 5 through 7. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. And the idea of the song of fools is just all the flattery that people tell you. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is futility. Surely oppression makes a wise man mad, and a gift destroys the heart. What is he saying? I believe what the writer is saying, I think what he's teaching us here is that rebuke really is a good thing. Go over with me, if you will, to Proverbs chapter 27. And let me just read this. You know this is one of my favorite passages. And it is because I have to tell you, as I'm going to this passage, I probably like rebuke less than most people. You know, I don't like to hear that I'm wrong, but I know I need to hear it. In Proverbs 27, down in verse 5, Solomon says it like this. Open rebuke is better than hidden or secret love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. And I'm just going to read that part of it. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. You know, if a good friend, a close friend, someone who really cares about you, points out something to you that you need to hear, doesn't feel good, it wounds you. I don't want to hear that. I don't want to be told that's where I am. I don't want to be rebuked for who I am and what I am. But it's faithful. It is exactly what I need. You'll notice later in this passage, in verse 17, and I happen to love this analogy, iron sharpens iron. And if you've ever sharpened anything, or if you've ever seen a sharp blade put on a knife or an axe or anything like that, you know sparks fly. And when iron sharpens iron, it is a tough thing. I mean, that iron hits that blade, the sparks fly, etc., etc. But in the end, you get the sharp axe or the sharp knife blade. That's what friends do. This idea back in Ecclesiastes, if you turn back there and you look at chapter 7, this whole idea of the song of fools and all of this, the gift that he's talking about, all of this, the word gift there, incidentally, in your translation may say it, is a bribe. And I happen to think that's what people do in life. And sometimes they literally pay money, but more than that, people pay compliments and they exchange appreciations and platitudes and so forth, and they kind of give them back and forth. You know, you wash my back, I wash yours. You pat my back, I'll pat yours. You build me up and I'll build you up, and we'll just make everybody feel good all the time. And you have to look at that sometimes and wonder, what's the point? What good is really going on here? What good is coming from this? And you realize that no, a friend will really take you aside sometimes and say to you, time to sharpen some iron. I know you're a good person. I love you. We wouldn't be friends if I didn't love you and you didn't love me. Oh, we know all that. But you really need to hear this right now. That's why the writer is saying here, just like going to a funeral, going to a time when a real friend rebukes you faithfully and sharpens your countenance is a great thing. That's those circumstances in life we're talking about. You need that. Do I want it? Would I choose it? Or would I be like the kid in the candy store? Of course I don't want it. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to go through it. I don't want to have you tell me what I need to hear that I've been failing in. But it's a good thing. Now finally, notice as he goes on here in this passage, in verse 8, he says, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof. And the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not hasty in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. Don't say, what is the cause that the former days were better than these, for you don't inquire wisely concerning this. I think he speaks of things that make you angry here, obviously. And what makes you angry, and it's interesting. If you're an individual who responds or reacts, you know, you feel, then all kinds of things come in life. And they can be small little things, you know, like irritations, just this little thing that irritates you and angers you. They can be great tragedies, and you get angry over that. And so we hear people sometimes, you know, why did God take so-and-so out of my life? Be mad at God. You know, be angry with God for doing that, etc., etc. They can be something that, you know, you legitimately should be angry over. This thing this person is doing or those people are doing is wrong. And it should anger you. It even angered the Son of God when people did wrong. So it should anger you. But that's not the point, is it? Those things are going to be there. From the irritations to the unrighteous things that people do, those things are going to be there. What is he saying? If you respond to it, verse 8, you'll be patient. Not proud. Patient means you will endure it, you will listen, you'll be slow to wrath, you'll consider, you'll lay it to heart, all those things. You will be patient, not proud. And you will see the thing through to its end. You won't be just quick to react, but you'll carry it all the way through. Verse 9, you won't be quick to get anger, but beyond that, you won't harbor it. Like we talked about this morning. You know, the natural outgrowth of anger is bitterness. That's when it destroys. A root of bitterness springing up that overtakes you and destroys. And many people are defiled by that. Hebrews 12:15. You won't let that happen. You will be angry, but you'll get past it and get over it and realize it for what it is. And finally, verse 10, you won't fall into the trap of always saying, it was better before, etc., etc. You know, it's like the two people that come into a marriage. And I don't know about you, but I know this is the case with me. Montel and I love each other very much, but did you know that we disagree sometimes? I don't know if you knew that or not. And do you know that sometimes we actually make each other angry? And we could have come into our marriage and we could have said from the very beginning and started a pattern of behavior that every time I did something or she did something that made the other one angry, we could have said, it was better before I was married. And that builds and it grows until the relationship you have is wishing you never had married the individual. Now for the Christian, for the world, it's just, well, let's get a divorce. For the Christian, it is, we're married, Jack. Wish we weren't. And I know plenty of members of the church that are right there. The writer is saying, don't bemoan how it used to be. Make it better now. You know, listen to each other. If you've got a legitimate gripe against each other, then listen and grow in all of those things. That's applying wisdom. Listen to verse 11 as he goes on with this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance. I think the translation, like the American Standard, wisdom is as good as an inheritance. And by it, there is profit to them that are under or see the sun. For wisdom is as a defense, verse 12. And money is as a defense. But the excellency of knowledge or wisdom is this, that wisdom gives life to those who have it. You know what he's saying is this. There are a lot of things in life that you can use as a defense, and people do all the time. Money is a defense. Money makes this life better, but it doesn't save you. And all the things that people pile up in life, the enjoyments, the parties, the getting drunk, and everything else, all of the things that people do to placate themselves, they don't save you. Well, they may get you through the moment. And they may make you feel better right now, but they don't save you. The Christian goes beyond that. He looks at the worst of situations. He considers the work of God. And I'm going to close by looking at this verse and continue reading with me here. When he says, verse 13, consider the work of God. For who can make that straight which he's made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. Make a pearl out of grit. It occurred to me a long time ago that God, perhaps, created animals for us to learn lessons in life. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Look how he works and how he prepares and how he stores up food and so forth and so on. Work like the ant. Don't be lazy and suffer the consequences. I want to suggest to you another little animal, an oyster. And you know, an oyster is one of the simplest animals in the chain of life. It just kind of lays around on the seafloor. And as it's laying there, sometimes a little grit, tiny little grit of sand will get inside the shell and embed itself in the oyster. Now, the oyster could just be irritated by it. It's not going away. It's going to stay there, and it could live the rest of its existence being irritated and whatever by the little bit of sand. I don't know if oysters feel, get angry, or whatever, but if we as humans had that, we do. We let those little grits of sand sometimes build and build and build till they destroy us. But the oyster, God has created to do something very special. It begins to secrete a substance. And that substance surrounds the grit. And it keeps on layering it and layering and working at it and working at it and working at it until a diver finds the oyster at some point and finds a beautiful pearl that the oyster has created. And if you were to take that pearl and you were to put it under a microscope and look deep down inside it, you'd still find a little grit of sand. It's very rare. It's very beautiful. And I think there's a lesson there for you and I. The grits of sands of the of our life are not going away. But what you do with them is your choice. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, if you believe in Jesus tonight, you'll confess your belief, repent, be baptized for forgiveness of them. The Lord will save you and begin to work in your life. And you know, if you're here and you've done that, and there's something that needs to be put behind you tonight, our God is a merciful God. Won't you please come while TJ leads us in this song?